Richard Russo was in his early 40s when he published his great novel Nobody's Fool in 1993. It focuses on the residents of a fictional mill town in upstate New York called Bath. It's mainly about Sully, who Paul Newman played in the movie version of the book, and his slow-on-the-uptake friend, Rub. Today, Richard Russo is in his mid-60s, and after all these years, he just brought Sully and Rub back to life in a sequel to Nobody's Fool called Everybody's Fool. The writer and novelist Jenny Boylan has been friends with Russo for about 25 years.
Hey, Russo.
Hey, Boylan. How you doing?
We gotta stop meeting like
I know.
Good to see you.
You too.
Back in the 1990s at Colby College in Maine, they shared an office as professors. But at the time, Jenny Boylan was Jim Boylan. She made the transition to Jenny about 15 years ago, and it threw her friend Russo for a loop. She wrote about it in her acclaimed memoir, She's Not There. We invited the two of them into Studio 360 to talk about big plot twists in their books and in their friendship.
Richard Russo, hello.
Hello, Jenny.
When was the last time I called you Richard?
I think before we met.
Which would have been 20 years ago?
Yeah.
How long have I known you?
Yeah. I started calling you Jenny much later than you.
All right, Russo, you're on.
All right.
Hey, so there's this rumor you've got a new book out and that it's, in fact, called Everybody's Fool. Let's hear a reading from it. Have you got something for us?
You bet I do.
Please set it up. Tell us who Doug Raymer is and what he suspects about the garage door opener that he's found.
Well, Raymer's wife, Becca, has had a terrible, tragic fall about a year before the book opens up. And there's a note, and he finds that his beloved wife is not only dead, but has been unfaithful, and she's about to run off with someone he knows not who. And he has no way to find out until he finds a remote, a garage door remote, in her car that does not open the door to their garage. And so that's where we pick up. Could be she let somebody borrow her car, Cherise continued, and this other person dropped the remote in there. But, Raymer said, if somebody borrowed the car, why would that person have his garage door opener on him? Wouldn't it be in his car? Do you carry your remote around in your purse? I don't have one. I don't even have a garage, and it's none of your business what's in my purse. Okay, Raymer said, ignoring her. With Cherise, you did well to ignore a good portion of what she said. Then how did it get wedged up under the driver's seat? She shrugged. Could be an innocent explanation, is all I'm saying. He raised an eyebrow at this. Admit it. You've been thinking sideways since Becca passed. Selling the condo, she meant. Moving into the Morrison Arms, selling the Rav instead of his Jetta. All three decisions motivated by spite and self-loathing. And anyhow, Cherise went on, standing over him now with her hands on her hips. Suppose you're right, which you aren't. Your plan is to do what exactly? Go around to every house in Bath and point that thing at all the garages? See which door goes up? That was, in a nutshell, the very plan taking shape in Raymer's brain, though he was reluctant to admit it to someone so clearly determined to deride it. But was it such a bad idea? After all, Bath was a small place, and he could cover it, neighborhood by neighborhood, in his spare time. Wouldn't that be just good mechanical police work, eliminating the innocent from your inquiries?
Oh, that's great. Actually, you know what I love about that? There is a woman who is the voice of reason.
Now, they tend to be the sharper knives in the drawer.
Trying to talk some sense into a man who has got an idea, which seems perfectly logical to him.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a fairly typical interplay between men and women in your work?
In my life.
Don't start with me, Russo. Are we going there so soon?
No. Yeah, I think Cherise is very much the voice of reason throughout this book, and various other women and throughout the course of the novel. They seem to be involved with men, number one, who are circling the drain in one fashion or another. And they can see where these guys are headed, though they can't. And they try to interrupt their progress. And of course, these guys are having none of it.
I was delighted to see, of all the characters that we revisit again, of course, Reb and Sully. Maybe we should take a moment and just explain, who are these characters? What is their friendship like?
Well, Sully in the earlier book is 60 years old, and he's just fallen off a ladder and shattered his knee. And he's done hard physical labor all his life long. And now he's coming kind of into the final turn, he can't work anymore, but he also can't not work anymore. So what is he going to do? He's come to depend a lot more on his buddy, his best friend, really, Rub Squeers. And Rub is a little bit slow, not terribly quick on the uptake, and needs a lot of instruction and a lot of pointing from his best friend, Sully.
You know, we should mention the relationship between Sully and Rub. It's really as deep as anything in a married relationship. Did you find it hard to write that about that kind of relationship? I ask you just because it's the kind of relationship that the relationship between friends,
mm-hmm.
And maybe particularly between men, I think it's mm-hmm. hard to write about.
It was a difficult relationship because on face value, it seems to be one-sided because Rub really needs Sully for everything. But there is something going on there between them. Rub is a kind of foil, and maybe Sully needs Rub the way Don Quixote needs Sancho.
That's funny. I was going to say the way Dean Martin needs Jerry Lewis.
yes, both. So there is, and also I think that part of Sully's mechanism, the way he goes about life, is to ignore all obligations that are enforceable. And so he leaves his family. But what does he go? He goes and finds Rub, who becomes his surrogate son.
Nobody's Fool is not only a great novel, but it's also a great film. You didn't write the screenplay for the movie version of Nobody's Fool, but it's very faithful to your novel. Paul Newman plays the character of Sully in the movie, and Philip Seymour Hoffman plays Doug Raymer, the small-town cop.
What's the matter now, Raymer?
Broken taillight. It's the third time. One more time, Sully, and I'm impounding this heap of yours.
Jesus Christ. Raymer, it's Thanksgiving.
Yeah, well, if you fixed it the first time, this wouldn't happen. It's $15. You can mail it in or you can come by the station. If it's not paid within 30 days, you'll be held in contempt.
Boy, I hope you get laid sometime soon.
Yeah, someday, smartass. I'm gonna nail you. Hey, when you least expect it.
That was Paul Newman, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Even for people who read the book first, it is really hard not to picture those actors when those characters are reintroduced in this new novel. Do you care that readers might be picturing those actors?
It would be rather hypocritical of me to care because that's how I see them as well. Yeah. They say that great actors own roles, and I think that that's true. I was already 250 pages into the book when we got the terrible news about Philip's death. And, my first thought was, well, I'm going to have to start thinking about somebody else now. It would be best to put Philip's image out of my mind. And then I thought, no, that's crazy. I mean, in a perfect world, if this is made into a movie half as good as Nobody's Fool, then some other actor who doesn't look like Philip Seymour Hoffman is going to come on and find Raymer in himself, in something inside him, and that will be just fine.
Do you think that readers believe in some sort of fictional Richard Russo based on the voice of the man who's telling them this story? I'm asking you this, which is really more of a statement than a question, because even though I write mostly nonfiction these days, people assume that we're going to be friends. I'm frequently, in fact, running into people here on the streets of New York who want to know if we can go and have coffee right then.
Right. Yeah.
What do people assume about Rick Russo, the author?
Well, I work really hard in all of these books to create a better person on the page than I am in real life.
That wouldn't be hard.
I think that's what writers do. I think we're never better than we are on the page. You write a book and it takes you forever and you make all kinds of mistakes and then you finally figure out what you're doing and you go back and you take out all of the worst mistakes, the ones that you can find, and you make it look like you knew what you were doing all along. That's right. The final illusion. And that's the person, that's the Jetty Boylan that these people on the streets of New York want to have coffee with Jetty, not you.
They want to know my final draft. They don't want to know my first draft.
That's right. The first, the ugly drafts, they're not interested in that at all. They want the you of your very best sentence, the very best sentence that you ever wrote. That's the you that they want.
All right. So I wrote about our friendship in my memoir, She's Not There. And I may have never asked you this question. Mm. Did you feel that I was the Richard Russo that I described in She's Not There, someone that you recognized? Did that seem like you?
Sure, sure. That was recognizably me. So what I got a sense of, a fascinating sense of seeing myself through your eyes, was revisiting times in our relationship during your transition that were painful, other times where the power of our friendship really took over. And those were wonderful to relive.
In that book, I printed an email that you had sent me not too long after I came at you. And you wrote this, and I quote, "Boylan, I've always known and never doubted that if I called you, you'd be right there. I never knew that you'd show up in heels." But that's hardly the point, isn't it? I think you had a great sense of humor about my transition. I think it was necessary. But it's fair to say that it was also something that you struggled with.
Of course. Yes. Yes. Some of what I was having so much difficulty wrapping my mind around has now been clarified and is out there in the culture much more. And that's largely, I think, due to you. Not just the kind of education that you gave me before you wrote the book, but the kind of education you gave America in writing all three of your memoirs. I mean, in the culture now, gender is much more fluid, seemed to be much more fluid than it was when you first explained what was going on to me.
I mean, did you feel that you were losing your friend at the time? Is that part of what was...
At the very beginning, I felt that. But over the course of your transition, of course, it became obvious, clear, and apparent to me that that was not going to happen. And once I put that aside, then everything changed. But what also was in play in our relationship had, I think, nothing to do with gender. And that was the sense that I thought that I knew you in a way that intellectually I know, you know, we all know that nobody knows anybody completely. Part of the reason we become novelists, I think, is to plumb to some degree the mystery of other people's souls. But despite that, we go through life believing that we understand people. And when something as fundamental as what you told me occurs, part of what's happening is not just can I wrap my mind around this, but you're saying to yourself, if I was so wrong, what the hell else am I missing? Hmm. You know?
When you see me now, do you see the person I used to be, or do you see the woman before you now?
I see the person that you are now. I see my old friend Jim in you, and I loved Jim the way I love you now. It's for me just kind of not really an issue anymore.
Right. All right. So
we're friends. I told you at one point after you had told me what was going on in your life and what your life had been like. And I said to you, it's strange because there were very few people in my life at that point about which I would have said I would change absolutely nothing. And you were one of those people. And that is still true. But you're different. You're the same. You are my old friend and you are my new friend. And none of the rest of it just makes any difference.
Well, I want to ask you one more question about Everybody's Fool, but I have to make sure I don't weep for a moment in response to that. But I guess the question I'm wondering is the same question as it applies to all of these other old friends of yours. Everyone in that wonderful fictional town, which is as real to most of your readers as the lives that they live in, mm-hmm. when you started writing about them again, mm-hmm. about a dozen years later, fictionally,
10 years,
10 years later,
yep,
fictionally,
10 years later.
But
yep.
23
yep.
years later
yep.
in reality.
Yep.
How long did it take before you saw who they were now? Or did you only see who they were? You know what I'm asking? Of you about your characters,
yes.
the same question that I asked you about me.
Yes, yes. And the answer is pretty much the same. I knew they were different. I knew they were the same. And I began to sense that the reason that they were different was not just because they had changed, but because I had. There's a scene between Sully and Miss Burrell. It's a flashback. And we know that Sully, who has just graduated from high school and has a terrible home life, on impulse has signed up to join the war. He is
this is World War II.
This is World War II. Miss Burrell, on the other hand, is not convinced. She fears not that he will die or that he will be injured, but that his self, who he is, will be damaged and he will come back as someone he doesn't recognize and maybe someone that she won't. And I think in the back of Sully's mind, even after signing up, has thought that maybe she won't let him. And she does. That scene is a scene that I couldn't have written in 1992, 1993, because I wasn't there yet. I wasn't the writer then that I am now. And because I've changed, that relationship between Sully and Miss Burrell has changed.
It's so funny to be reading this book in the midst of going to a 40th high school reunion for me, because as I've read this book, it was very much the feeling that I had. Here are these people who, some of whom I've thought about a lot, Sully and Rub, and not only because it's always been our private joke that I'm Rub and you're Sully, but also that there are some people whom I hadn't thought about. Mm-hmm. Officer Raymer, mm-hmm. who I hadn't thought about for 25 years.
Right.
But here they all are, or many of them are. Some of them are gone. But here they all are. And the point was not whether or not they've all succeeded.
Right.
And the point was not even whether or not many of them have failed. The point was that here we all still are. Mm-hmm. And in spite of all the changes, they are just like you and me. What's that? The phrase Mary Carr uses, we are our same selves.
Right.
And for me, that was tremendously hopeful. No matter what happens to people, we are still our same selves.
I think that should be the last word.
Russo, thanks for sitting down with me. Richard Russo's new novel is entitled Everybody's Fool. It's out now everywhere. It's great work. It's a great book.
Thank you, Chetty.
I'm just so excited by the whole thing.